Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Välkommen till Kungliga Vetenskapsakademin och den här presskonferensen då vi ska presentera årets Nobelpris i fysik.
It's that time of year again when past breakthroughs in science get the accolade of a Nobel Prize. Three in all, in medicine or physiology, in physics and in chemistry. It's also the week of the recurring controversies. Did the right people get it? Where are the women winners? This year, in particular, it's all men from the US or Europe. And a rarer one this year, is this even physics? The mystique of the Nobels is a bit of a mystery, but the moment does always capture me, a chance to revisit key issues in science. So, here is your BBC Science in Action guide to the 2024 laureates with me, Roland Pease, hearing especially from those who've worked closely with the winners, including one whose lifelong collaboration extends from home to lab.
It's my cousin says, it's a mom and pop shop. Yeah. And, you know, this is our family business. We made our kids work for us. Running gels, blotting Northerns. Unfortunately, none of them decided to go into biology.
Rosalind Candy Lee, whose husband, Victor Ambros, was awarded the prize in medicine and physiology. Keep listening for a truly joyous interview with the two of them on living and working together, the joy of science, and that blind spot the Nobels have with gender. But let's go in reverse order, starting with Wednesday's prize, chemistry, the one that we've been talking about most here on Science in Action recently, because it's a truly fast-moving field. The use of artificial intelligence to speed up our understanding of the chemistry of proteins, the molecular engines of life. Half went to biochemist John Jumper and his boss at DeepMind, Demis Hassabis, for AlphaFold, an AI for working out the 3D structure of proteins from just their genetic code.
You know, the protein folding problem, this problem of figuring out the 3D structure of proteins, has been a 50-year grand challenge in biology, because knowing the structure of a protein helps you understand what its function is in the body. So this week we are releasing the human proteome, which is all 20,000 proteins in the human body.
All of our machinery.
It is. It's kind of amazing that it all works. You know, I mean, it's the miracle of life that all these proteins, you know, go about doing their critical jobs in your body seamlessly. We don't even notice it, of course, day to day. And this teeming activity is happening under the hood. And, you know, we want to know what those proteins do.
Demis Hassabis talking to Science in Action in 2021 when DeepMind released their AlphaFold code. The other half went to David Baker of the University of Washington for working in the opposite direction, finding out what genetic code you'd need if you wanted to make a protein of a specific form or function. He was on the program last year when he had shown how AI could help there too.
We have several different AI methods to do this, and we're using them now to make proteins to combat viruses and catalyze plastic degradation, capture sunlight for energy. So the neat thing about protein design is there are so many different functions that can be useful to humanity that can now be designed. And once you've designed a protein, it's very easy to get bacteria to make lots of the protein, so it can really go out in the world and do lots of good things.
David Baker of the Institute for Protein Design and one of this year's Nobel laureates in chemistry. Erica De Benedictis is a computer scientist turned biologist running the biodesign lab in the Francis Crick Institute in London. But immediately before that, she was with David Baker's team, wondering how to invent ever better proteins.
David Demis and John Jumper getting a Nobel Prize for this was only a matter of time. I think it's been really obvious. Like, the impact this has had on the field has been enormous. I was in the Baker lab. I was doing a postdoc when AlphaFold 2 came out. So that was a really cool time to be kind of in the thick of things. And David's lab has been chewing on this, how do we engineer proteins, which are these crazy, floppy, gooey, tiny, tiny things that do so many things in our cells and can do so many things for the world, therapeutics, enzymes, like all this stuff. But they have been so hard to engineer. And he has been tackling that problem for 20 years. And it's the advances in AI that generated this step change in how easy it is to engineer proteins. So, you know, in the Baker lab, about a couple weeks after AlphaFold 2 got released, David made an announcement at group meeting, and he basically said, okay, new rule, before you place DNA orders, which are quite expensive, you have to run your designs through AlphaFold. And if AlphaFold okays them, you get to order it. If AlphaFold does not okay them, you don't get to order it. And even that simple rule increased how often the engineering worked by, in some cases, tenfold. This was a big deal. It made a big dent in how easy it was to engineer proteins.
That's amazing. You just run it through the computer. You've got a concept of a design, run it through the computer. The computer says, yeah, go ahead with this. And then you do the expensive stuff of doing wet lab chemistry.
Exactly.
And one of the reasons I was quite surprised these prizes came so quickly is that the Nobel committees tend to want to see sort of really concrete, real-world examples of how these have benefited mankind, as Nobel put it, humanity. When I was speaking to David Baker, he did say you had some therapeutics and some, I think, some vaccines sort of in development. Are you seeing benefits straight away?
That's true. Yeah. The Baker lab during COVID engineered a protein that can be a COVID therapeutic. And unlike many of the other COVID therapeutics, because that protein is designed by humans, we're able to make it shelf stable. So you could keep it around at room temperature. You wouldn't have to have cold chain, which is very hard to do like in third world countries. You could also do things like it could be like a nasal spray. So you would like inhale something that would protect you, like a prophylactic. Yeah, I think the Baker Lab has had quite a number of spin out companies already that are sort of based on designed proteins that have been in the works, some of them even predating some of these breakthroughs in structure prediction. And so for sure, I think it's already clear that protein engineering is a big deal and can change the world. And there's quite a few spin-out companies already that are trying to take those proteins to market.
It just give me an idea, since you've been there, what's the buzz like there? Is it different from some other labs in terms of the feeling like you're at the front line?
You know, all labs are different. David has a unique style for how he runs his lab. He loves the science. He spends his entire life in 30-minute calls or meetings with every single person in his lab. And he manages to meet with all like 120 people in his lab, not less often than once every 3 weeks, like per person. Like, this guy arranges his whole life so that he actually gets to engage with the science, which is really cool. I think there's very few people who run large research labs who take that approach. Yeah, David, he's a really cool person. He's a great mentor, and he has done some really cool science. There are very few researchers in protein engineering who were not trained by David. Like, he has cornered the market on training us, which is pretty cool. It's just, it feels like everyone in the world is a Baker Lab alum in this tiny community.
Biodesigner Erica De Benedictis illustrating the power of AI in accelerating chemistry. AlphaFold and protein design were widely tipped, though I'm not used to the Nobel committees being so fast on the uptake. my worry had been we'd be so keen to celebrate the uses of AI that we'd forget its first pioneers, the people who worked out the computer gubbins that make it work. The physics prize sorted that. It was shared between two pioneers. Geoffrey Hinton, who's caught the headlines more recently worrying about what he'd unleashed.
Most of the researchers I know believe that probably within the next 20 years, we're going to be able to make things that are more intelligent than us. And nobody knows how that's going to turn out.
But his share of the prize was for one of the first neural nets, as they're called, in the 1980s, the Boltzmann machine, named for the 19th century German physicist who worked out the atomic laws of heat and energy. Geoffrey Hinton had started out in psychology, studying vision in particular, turning to computer science to work out the underlying mechanics of how neurons in our brain interact to generate thought and memory. A year or two ahead of him, the other laureate, John Hopfield, already had a distinguished career in physics when, looking for a more challenging topic, he decided to apply his maths to the functioning brain.
My motivation was really understanding more about how the brain works. It would be necessary to understand thought, consciousness, or what have you, that it somehow was related to collective phenomena in networks. And I slowly wove my way from an interest in how the brain functioned to a question of how could hardware or software, or whatever you want to call it, wetware, produce such a thing.
Now, in his 90s, John Hopfield is slowing down at last, but his work keeps going. His youngest collaborator, Dima Krotov of IBM Research, wasn't even born when his mentor first invented the Hopfield network in 1982. But like the professor, he started out in physics before changing discipline. And I thought he'd be ideal for challenging the criticism that this was a prize for computer science, not for physics.
Why was it a remarkable paper? You know, it's kind of like a rare example when three things come together in one piece of work, right? And these three things are the inspiration from physics, from statistical physics, the neurobiology, and the machine learning and AI. And I think what was so remarkable about John's 1982 paper that he was able to connect the dots. So he was able to put together all these ingredients in one coherent paper. And he was able to convince people that indeed it makes sense to think about biological neurons. And when I say biological, there are many caveats here, because of course his model of a neuron is very, very abstract. But it was just the right level of abstraction that kind of allowed him to, on the one hand, formalize that notion mathematically. And on the other hand, it was sufficiently close to biology so that biologists could also extract something useful from it. And, you know, the same thing with machine learning. So kind of like the influence that that paper had on the field of machine learning and AI is absolutely profound. So essentially, like anytime we hear anything about restricted Boltzmann machines, that's a follow-up on Hopfield's 1982 paper. Whenever people talk about energy-based modeling, so there's a lot of discussions in today's AI about energy-based modeling, and in fact, it is one of the most promising paradigms in the field. And if you think about it, it all traces back to his ideas of physical systems that can do computation on a sufficiently sophisticated rugged energy landscape.
I mean, in my reading, the connection is that he was already doing quantum mechanics stuff on atoms, billions of atoms in a solid, and he sort of starts off by almost treating the neuron, the unit of thought, as an atom, and it's the way that they connect up that was the sort of the lever
that
he used.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, like, there's absolutely no question that John is a physicist in all possible senses, in the conventional sense of the word physicist, in the unconventional, in the more sort of open-minded definition of the word physics. So John came from a very, you know, rigorous condensed matter theory background. He wrote very influential papers prior to writing his most famous paper on the Hopfield model. Later on, he did another important work on kinetic proofreading. And that work by itself was foundational and started the whole field of kinetic proofreading in biophysics, something related to biology. And of course, neural network was a step even further because in the 1982 paper on the Hopfield model, it was not just a step towards biology, but also a step towards physical systems that can do computation and to neural networks. And that became, over the years, what we now call AI.
I mean, what's interesting is reading a few of his papers, he still considers himself to be a physicist, but a physicist on the interface with biology. And presumably somehow he inspired you, because you changed from a different branch of physics yourself. So there's some kind of
Absolutely.
There.
You know, I think it is 100% correct that John, maybe he wasn't the first one who went from conventional physics to biology or to other disciplines. But he was certainly, a very bright example of a successful transition of that sort. And, Roland, these past couple of days, there has been a lot of discussions. What is physics? What is chemistry? What is biology? And how to put boundaries? From my perspective, coming from a more sort of interdisciplinary background, and as you said, I'm a physicist by training, but I work in at a company, at a research division of IBM Research, right? And we do a lot of AI research, and we do a little bit of neuroscience research as well. And to me, those boundaries between the disciplines, they're somewhat blurred. And frankly, I prefer not to think about them. To me, what matters is the interesting questions. And then whether or not this is physics or biology or AI, or sometimes people even argue what is AI and what is machine learning, or maybe what is statistics and what is machine learning. To me, this could be an interesting questions for a beer party, right? But in some sense, I don't really think they add much to the actually exciting questions that we are addressing as a community today.
Dima Krotov, keeping the flame alive for a physics approach to neuroscience.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
The Medicine Prize also has its roots in information science and in puzzles of the 1980s. RNA is, alongside DNA, the molecule of information in biology, carrying the code that makes the proteins that make our body function. See how all these prizes link together. Last year's prize was for the science of hacking RNA to get it to make the proteins we need for COVID vaccines. That was mRNA. This year, it's microRNA, chemically the same stuff, but incredibly short snips of it that interact with the conventional threads to regulate how our body reads its genetic program. All very meta. You can listen to Health Check with Claudia Hammond on why that's turned out to be important in medicine, for cancer, for example. But I was interested in the early work by laureates Gary Ruvkin and Victor Ambrose in separate but collaborating labs, worrying over the odd growth patterns of tiny nematode worms. I dug out Victor's key paper from 1993 and saw there were just two co-authors who'd probably done a lot of the lab work, Rhonda Feinbaum and Rosalind Lee. Perhaps Rosalind could tell us about those early days, I thought, if we could find her. Turned out to be easier than I'd guessed. She's still working with Victor and they're married. How could I turn down the chance to hear from both of them about a life in science? By the way, Though she's Rosalind on paper, she's candy to all who know her.
Yeah, we met in 1972, right, at MIT. And then we got married in 76. So we've been together, you know, for quite a while before we even started working together.
So, Candy, how did you, I mean, what brought you into looking at worms?
I was sort of between jobs and, you know, Victor needed a technician. He had just started his lab at Harvard. And, you know, I thought I might as well learn something about what he does. You know, I had been doing lots of other research projects before that. And so it just, you know, happened. Yeah. And, you know, so I'm not the worm expert. Victor's definitely the geneticist. And, you know, he knows every cell in the worm. I'm mostly a molecular biologist.
Yeah, I'm the OCD component of the team. Yeah.
But, yeah. Well, that's interesting. There's a comment in the history that you wrote 10 years after the first discovery. You make a point that you weren't actually interested in RNA and stuff at the time. Yeah, that you, yeah, were, you were looking at these worms and thinking there's something a bit weird.
Yeah, it was really about questions of developmental mechanisms more broadly. And in this case, the mutants that we were studying had these very intriguing developmental timing defects, right? So we thought the worm could, right here, being giving us an opportunity to study, you know, developmental timers and those the molecular mechanisms thereof. But we figured it would be working by the kinds of mechanisms we were already familiar with. But the timing dimension was the part that was particularly intriguing.
So at what point the effects of the mutations would kick in, I guess you're saying?
Yeah.
But this, so yeah, this is about, I mean, first of all, RNA. Luckily, our listeners know a lot more about RNA than they did 5 years ago, because of the vaccines and so on. But you were looking at little bits of genetic material that were controlling other bits of genetic material. But you had a guess at that. You had a suspicion there might be something like that going on?
No, not at all. That's what I say. Well, the assumption was we were going to, you know, Candy's and Rhonda were cloning LIN4, and we expected to find a protein at the LIN4 locus, you know, where the mutation was. Yeah. And it turned out the mutation told us that, well, it might be a protein, but then the biological activity of the little bits of DNA that Candy and Rhonda were purifying and injecting into the worm, you know, little bits of DNA as short as only, you know, 800 nucleotide base pairs would function as LIN4. So, and that sequence did not contain any protein coding sequence.
And, yeah, no open reading frames, you know.
And Candy worked. Yeah. So that was the idea. And so, you know, and Candy actually did an amazing series of experiments to really nail down the fact that that sequence, 800 base pairs, could not possibly encode a protein. So that we wanted to go to press, so to speak, with confidence and not end up with egg on our face down the road.
I mean, looking back at the paper, I'm seeing phrases which nowadays we don't sort of worry about. It's genetic biology is so much simpler with the sequencing machines these days. But this was really hard lab work that you were doing, Candy, I guess.
Yeah, and there was no computer tools. I had to do alignments by hand. Nobody knows how to do, you know, make phage libraries anymore and lifts and stuff like that. You know, radioactivity galore.
Yeah, this is all old school.
Yeah, very old school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it was tough, and you really thought it was worth pursuing.
Well, you know, I'm a dogged person. I'm not going to walk away. You know, I've invested so much time. And, you know, you get incremental progress and, you know, so it was a 5KB, rearrangement, mutation, lesion, and it just whittling it down. And when I got it to 800, then we could really, you know, work with it.
And so you could find this tiny bit of RNA, which you worked out by collaborating with Gary Rukin, that it was affecting the behavior of another gene.
Yeah, I mean, I like to say that, to emphasize that in the interaction with our two labs, Gary Robkins and my lab, was an interesting one. And it's not the usual kind of, let's say, collaboration, because each one of us had independently decided, you know, to devote each of our labs to kind of the high, you know, it's a lot of work to clone a gene back in the you know, late 80s and the 90s. So, you know, two people in my lab and two people in his lab, each cloning a gene. And they found that LIN14, you know, encoded a regular protein, but it had these sequences in the non-coding region of the mRNA, right, that apparently were regulatory in nature. And they were able to show the part, they were able to determine the parts of that sequence that were responsible for the regulation by LIN4. And we could show by genetic means that it was LIN4 that was regulating LIN14 and not the opposite, you know. And so here the RNA sequence was in the LIN14 was mediating the regulation by LIN4. And we in our lab found that LIN4 encoded a tiny RNA. And at that point, we weren't collaborating. We shared our information. So Gary and I got together and said, hey, what's the story? You've got that. You've got that. Let's see if they may be base pair to each other. And sure enough, they did. So it was
there was a moment, was there, of sort of eureka. Hang on. I see something in yours that you can see mine.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's probably the central, most treasured scientific moment of my life, you know, is our sharing of that. And I like to emphasize to people that there's three, you know, there's sort of three dimensions to science. You know, there's collaboration, there's competition, and there's also this free sharing of data, ideas, you know, inferences. And in the best scientific context, that's happening naturally, you know, and so that's where the competition came in, sort of like, let's do the best we can and really impress people, you know. But
you and Gary Rufkin also published back to back, I think. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So we communicated, you know, we coordinated those two manuscripts. Yeah.
I mean, the other aspect of science, which I think, and particularly in biology, which I find so interesting, is the layers of depth in biology. So we, as communicators, we often talk about DNA and RNA being the molecules of the information, and it all gets turned into something else. And it's actually, it's more like an Escher stairway, the way these different bits of biology interact, the proteins to RNA. And I think, you know, that's what you seem to have plucked out.
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation, because basically what we're, you know, what we're learning to appreciate more and more, you know, constantly, is that nature takes advantage of any opportunity whatsoever to utilize molecular interactions for adaptive, you know, advantage, right? And so the systems inside the cell, they don't care about, you know, delegation. They don't say, like, you know, I can't interact with, you know, proteins. And so, you know, now there's discoveries that there's, you know, glycosylated RNAs with sugars sticking off the side, and we don't know what for. But then you stop to think, well, I mean, the RNA didn't sit there and say, no way, I can't be glycosylated, right? And the glycosylated enzymes aren't saying, you know, I don't touch RNA. Evolution allows these interactions to occur. And if they're advantageous, boom, they take off. And so we're finding just everything interacts with everything else, you know, and the beauty of it is all those interactions are either neutral or advantageous or essential for what the worm does, or what the animal does or the cell does, you know.
Bit by bit, I don't know how much it was in your labs or in other labs, the realization it wasn't just about worms. It's also about all kinds of higher organisms.
That's Gary's. I mean, Gary's great breakthrough. In fact, 1999 or 2000, they discovered another microRNA in C. elegans, a completely different sequence. You know, totally different gene somewhere else. And as it happened, LET7, the sequence of LET7, 22 nucleotides, is completely conserved perfectly in essentially all the animals. And so that was just utterly astonishing, because we really didn't have a way of thinking about what would be the evolutionary constraints on the entire sequence of a microRNA, especially since LIN4 was not so well sequenced, so well conserved. So it's not something in
there wasn't the human genome available
then. Yeah, I mean, with the genomes nowadays, with the genome available, you could find LIN4 with a certain kind of search, but not with the straightforward what we call blast search that Gary did, which is asking, I've got a 22-letter word. Is an identical word somewhere in the genome of some organism out there, right? You know, and that was a remarkable, I mean, not just remarkable, it was a watershed because, yeah, instantly we knew that, well, these animals, all the animals have had microRNAs since the common ancestor of all the bilaterian animals. That's 500-600 million years. And what I love about LET7, it's been, you know, 500 million years, LET7 sequence, it's been there unchanged in all of us. Yeah. And, you know, to this day, we still don't understand what is constraining the sequence of LET7. Right? I mean, it's still teaching us new mysteries about these microRNAs.
Candy, I'm quite curious. Victor's already confessed that he's the worm guy. You're the geneticist.
He's the geneticist. Yeah. I'm the molecular biologist.
Yeah, you're the molecular biologist. Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. But as a molecular biologist, you could have struck off in any place, but you decided to stick there and kind of husband and wife.
Well, as my cousin says, it's a mom and pop shop. Yeah. And, you know, this is our family business. We made our kids work for us. Running gels, blotting Northerns. Unfortunately, none of them decided to go into biology.
I mean,
but you know, I don't think people realize I just have a bachelor's degree in chemistry, not in biology. I did not go to graduate school. And in Victor's lab, I had a lot of freedom to do a project, which, most other places would, you know, if I wasn't related to them, would not have allowed me to have, right? So, you know, there is a hierarchy in biology, you know, the postdocs and graduate students and then the technicians. And you know, I was treated very well. I was treated very well in David Baltimore's lab, and that's where I learned to, you know, just want more.
But as a senior scientist of the lab, you must have been involved in training a lot of people going through there as well. I mean, you clearly have the respect.
I can say that, one of my weaknesses is management, you know, just managing the lab. And that includes, let's say, the proper awareness of the state of various people in the lab. And I think also because I'm sort of the professor, you know, maybe people in the lab would hesitate, you know, students or postdocs, to necessarily come to me, but they would come to Candy. And so, if somebody was having trouble or having issues with their, you know, with family or you know, you name it, they talk to Candy first. And what we realized early on, and then that we were complementary in a way that, that was, you know, really beneficial. I mean, if I was on my own, my lab would have a lot of constant issues that with Candy there would get nipped in the bud. And then also, you know, Candy would help me think about how to approach, you know, fixing the, or, you know, addressing the situation and stuff like that. And that was a constant learning process for me, actually. So, we've been complimentary in a way that is it's appreciated, I think, by the people who've been in my lab, but it's not always the case, you know, when we think about scientific partnerships, right, to consider the vital importance of the kinds of interpersonal, what's the word, you know, sort of
interactions, making group dynamics work.
Yeah.
But also because I'm so old, I mean, people come and they have this, you know, problem with their experiments. And I say,
yeah, the old way.
Can you do the old way, not the kit way. And here's how to do it.
I mean, you sort of brought me to a topic. I wasn't sure how to bring this up because I don't want to cause family friction and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But you will be aware there's a lot of commentary on the fact, Victor, that you've got the Nobel Prize and that Candy hasn't. I mean, if I can put this to you first, Candy, I don't know what your reflection would be on that because it is being commented on.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's unfortunate that my parents named me Rosalind, but always called me Candy. definitely it's a totally different thing from Maurice Wilkins and
Rosalind Franklin.
And Rosalind Franklin. And, you know, where the professor was not involved in the research at all.
Well, we don't have
and
to.
And got credit. Yeah. So, you know, and.
Yeah, there's plenty of. So people, yeah, right. Yeah, so people draw in a lot of analogies and try to draw candy into that analogy.
So.
But how do you feel about it? I think that's.
No, I mean, scientists just care that their work means something. You know, a true scientist. They don't care, you know. I mean, we actually, you know, are not dealing that well with the notoriety. But we just want to be known that we did that 1993 paper and it really made an impact and it opened up so much for other people.
Yeah, that's,
you know, so it really, that's what the satisfaction is. And the two of us, you know, did it together. And then also the, you know, 2001 paper.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I mean, the fact that science is inevitably about collaboration and the groups working on a project are, you know, they're not limited to one or two or three people who could fit onto the, you know, Nobel podium. And so I think we've learned to understand that these kinds of things are recognized by Nobel, you know, committee by focusing on, you know, the lab heads for better, or for worse, that's how it is. And then it's up to us to disabuse people of these assumptions they're making about folks being screwed, you know, and so forth. I mean, this is just the way it is. And what we're trying to do is to, in these, you know, in the context of this, is really discuss the collaboration, you know, collaboration between Rhonda Feinbaum and Rosalind Lee, and then their collaboration with me, and then the sharing of data. And then in Gary's lab, there's multiple authors, you know, and on that collaborative effort. So it's just a reality, a practical sort of compromise. And but it's wonderful that journalists like yourself are really addressing this really important
historical
and the fact of the collaborative effort of science is wonderful. It's a wonderful thing that they do.
I mean, as I mentioned at the beginning, I sought out Candy to talk in the first place, in particular because. On our program, I really like to underline how important the stuff that's being done by young people in the lab is, that it's not just the professors in their offices, it's the hard work and the presumably sometimes rewarding work when you're actually at the lab bench and you're manipulating genes or you're manipulating organisms and so on. And it's such hard work, but it's so important, Candy.
Yeah, I mean, the postdocs and students, they're just a treasure.
Well, I mean, you know, we've just had wonderful people in our lab and they're part of our family. I mean, we, you know, we go to their weddings, you know, mm-hmm. it's just amazing. You know, it's such a personal business. You know, people think it's a cold, lonely business. It's, you know, it's just so much fun.
Victor Ambros and Candy Lee, and congratulations to both of them for a life in world-changing science. For what it's worth, I also asked protein designer Erica De Benedictis what she made of the utter lack of diversity in this year's prizes.
Well, I think it's complicated. These prizes are incredibly well-deserved. You know, these all three, David, Demis, and John Jumper, are all, this is such a well-deserved prize. I think it is tough just for science in general as a discipline that, you know, forget Nobel Prizes, like the entire discipline has been male dominated for a very long time. And that's tough to break out of. I remember when I was younger, people would ask me like, oh, is Marie Curie your hero? And I'm like, what? Like, that's not a person I relate to. She was alive a long time ago. And I do think it's tough to not have role models. I mean, I think Frances Arnold had a big impact on the science I did because she's a really amazing scientist, but she did feel like the only person I could point to who was sort of someone whose career I maybe could aspire to. So, yeah, I mean, I think it would be lovely to see folks with more diversity represented in some of these big prizes. I would say this one does already feel like an improvement because it happened more quickly. It used to be that people would get Nobel Prizes like in their 20s. And recently that hasn't been the case, even though young folks and mid-career folks also do awesome science. So I think there's lots of dimensions worth paying attention to. And yeah, I wish the best of luck to all the scientists in the future getting these prizes, especially the women.
In short, in a biased world, prizes will amplify the inequalities, but the Nobels do seem to have taken a step backwards this year. Someone pointed out the physics prize has now gone 10 times to a man called John, but only 5 times to any woman. Maybe we should stop obsessing about these prizes, but it's a hard habit to kick. Back to business as usual next week in Science and Action from the BBC World Service. Till then, from me, Ronan Pease, and producer Alex Mansfield, thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.